The Everlasting Man by G.K. Chesterton. Book 1, Chapter 3. The Antiquity of Civilization. The modern man, looking at the most ancient origins, has been like a man watching for daybreak in a strange land, and expecting to see that dawn breaking behind bare uplands or solitary peaks. But that dawn is breaking behind the black bulk of great cities long builded and lost for us in the original night. Colossal cities, like the houses of giants, in which even the carved ornamental animals are taller than the palm trees, in which the painted portrait can be 12 times the size of the man, with tombs like mountains of man set foursquare and pointing to the stars, with winged and bearded bulls standing and staring enormous at the gates of temples, standing still eternally, as if a stamp would shake the world. The dawn of history reveals a humanity already civilized. Perhaps it reveals a civilization already old. And among other more important things, it reveals the folly of most of the generalizations about the previous and unknown period when it was really young. The two first human societies of which we have any reliable and detailed record are Babylon and Egypt. It so happens that these two vast and splendid achievements of the genius of the ancients bear witness against two of the commonest and crudest assumptions of the culture of the moderns. If we want to get rid of half the nonsense about nomads and cavemen and the old man of the forest, we need only look steadily to the two solid and stupendous facts called Egypt and Babylon. Of course, most of these speculators who are talking about primitive men are thinking about modern savages. They prove their progressive evolution by assuming that a great part of the human race has not progressed or evolved, or even changed in any way at all. I do not agree with their theory of change, nor do I agree with their dogma of things unchangeable. I may not believe that civilized man has had so rapid and recent a progress, but I cannot quite understand why uncivilized man should be so mystically immortal and immutable. A somewhat simpler mode of thought and speech seems to me to be needed throughout this inquiry. Modern savages cannot be exactly like primitive man because they are not primitive. Modern savages are not ancient because they are modern. Something has happened to their race as much as to ours during the thousands of years of our existence and endurance on the earth. They have had some experiences, and have presumably acted on them, if not profited by them, like the rest of us. They have had some environment, and even some change of environment, and have presumably adapted themselves to it in a proper and decorous evolutionary manner. This would be true even if the experiences were mild, or the environment dreary. For there is an effect in mere time when it takes the moral form of monotony. But it has appeared to a good many intelligent and well-informed people quite as probable that the experience of the savages has been that of a decline from civilization. Most of those who criticize this view do not seem to have any very clear notion of what a decline from civilization would be like. Heaven help them. It is likely enough that they will soon find out. They seem to be content if cavemen and cannibal islanders have some things in common, such as certain particular implements. But it is obvious on the face of it that any peoples reduced for any reason to a ruder life would have some things in common. If we lost all our firearms, we should make bows and arrows. but we should not necessarily resemble in every way the first men who made bows and arrows. It is said that the Russians, on their great retreat, were so short of armament that they fought with clubs cut in the wood. But a professor of the future would err in supposing that the Russian army of 1916 was a naked Scythian tribe that had never been out of the woods. It is like saying that a man in his second childhood must exactly copy his first. A baby is bald like an old man, but it would be an error for one ignorant of infancy to infer that the baby had a long white beard. Both a baby and an old man walk with difficulty, but he who shall expect the old gentleman to lie on his back and kick joyfully instead will be disappointed. It is therefore absurd to argue that the first pioneers of humanity must have been identical with some of the last and most stagnant leavings of it. There were almost certainly some things, there were probably many things, in which the two were widely different or flatly contrary. An example of the way in which this distinction works, and an example essential to our argument here, is that of the nature and origin of government. I have already alluded to Mr. H.G. Wells and the old man with whom he appears to be on such intimate terms. If we considered the cold facts of prehistoric evidence for this portrait of the prehistoric chief of the tribe, we could only excuse it by saying that its brilliant and versatile author simply forgot for a moment that he was supposed to be writing a history, and dreamed he was writing one of his own very wonderful and imaginative romances. At least I cannot imagine how he can possibly know that the prehistoric ruler was called the Old Man, or that court etiquette required it to be spelt with capital letters. He says of the same potentate, "No one was allowed to touch his spear or to sit in his seat." I have difficulty in believing that anybody has dug up a prehistoric spear with a prehistoric label, "Visitors are requested not to touch," or a complete throne with the inscription, "Reserved for the old man." But it may be presumed that the writer, who can hardly be supposed to be merely making up things out of his own head, was merely taking for granted this very dubious parallel between the prehistoric and the de-civilized man. It may be that in certain savage tribes the chief is called the old man, and nobody is allowed to touch his spear or sit on his seat. It may be that in those cases he is surrounded with superstitious and traditional terrors, and it may be that in those cases, for all I know, he is despotic and tyrannical. But there is not a grain of evidence that primitive government was despotic and tyrannical. It may have been, of course, for it may have been anything, or even nothing. It may not have existed at all. But the despotism in certain dingy and decayed tribes in the 20th century does not prove that the first men were ruled despotically. It does not even suggest it. It does not even begin to hint at it. If there was one fact we really can prove from the history that we really do know, it is that despotism can be a development, often a late development, and very often indeed the end of societies that have been highly democratic. A despotism may almost be defined as a tired democracy. As fatigue falls on a community, the citizens are less inclined for that eternal vigilance which has been truly called the price of liberty, and they prefer to arm only one single sentinel to watch the city while they sleep. It is also true that they sometimes needed him for some sudden and militant act of reform. It is equally true that he often took advantage of being the strong man armed to be a tyrant, like some of the sultans of the East. But I cannot see why the sultan should have appeared any earlier in history than many other human figures. On the contrary, the strong man armed obviously depends upon the superiority of his armor, and armament of that sort comes with more complex civilization. One man may kill 20 with a machine gun. It is obviously less likely that he could do it with a piece of flint. As for the current cant about the strongest man ruling by force and fear, it is simply a nursery fairy tale about a giant with 100 hands. 20 men could hold down the strongest strong man in any society, ancient or modern. Undoubtedly, they might admire, in a romantic and poetical sense, the man who really was the strongest. But that is quite a different thing, and is as purely moral and even mystical as the admiration for the purest or the wisest. But the spirit that endures the mere cruelties and caprices of an established despot is the spirit of an ancient and settled and probably stiffened society, not the spirit of a new one. As his name implies, the old man is the ruler of an old humanity. It is far more probable that the primitive society was something like a pure democracy. To this day, the comparatively simple agricultural communities are by far the purest democracies. Democracy is a thing which is always breaking down through the complexity of civilization. Anyone who likes may state it by saying that democracy is the foe of civilization. But he must remember that some of us really prefer democracy to civilization, in the sense of preferring democracy to complexity. Anyhow, peasants tilling patches of their own land in a rough equality, and meeting to vote directly under a village tree, are the most truly self-governing of men. It is surely as likely as not that such a simple idea was found in the first condition of even simpler men. Indeed, the despotic vision is exaggerated, even if we do not regard the men as men. Even on an evolutionary assumption of the most materialistic sort, there is really no reason why men should not have had at least as much camaraderie as rats or rooks. Leadership of some sort they doubtless had, as have the gregarious animals. But leadership implies no such irrational servility as that attributed to the superstitious subjects of the old man. There was doubtless somebody corresponding, to use Tennyson's expression, to the many-wintered crow that leads the clanging rookery home. But I fancy that if that venerable fowl began to act after the fashion of some sultans in ancient and decayed Asia, it would become a very clanging rookery, and the many-wintered crow would not see many more winters. It may be remarked in this connection that even among animals it would seem that something else is respected more than bestial violence, if it be only the familiarity which in men is called tradition, or the experience which in men is called wisdom. I do not know if crows really follow the oldest crow, but if they do, they are certainly not following the strongest crow. And I do know, in the human case, that if some ritual of seniority keeps savages reverencing somebody called old man, then at least they have not our own servile sentimental weakness for worshipping the strong man. It may be said, then, that primitive government, like primitive art and religion and everything else, is very imperfectly known, or rather guessed at, but that it is at least as good a guess to suggest that it was as popular as a Balkan or Pyrenean village, as that it was as capricious and secret as a Turkish divan. Both the mountain democracy and the Oriental palace are modern, in the sense that they are still there, or are some sort of growth of history. But of the two, the palace has much more the look of being an accumulation and a corruption, the village much more the look of being a really unchanged and primitive thing. But my suggestions at this point do not go beyond expressing a wholesome doubt about the current assumption. I think it interesting, for instance, that liberal institutions have been traced, even by moderns, back to barbarians or undeveloped states, when it happened to be convenient for the support of some race or nation or philosophy. So the socialists profess that their ideal of communal property existed in very early times. So the Jews are proud of the jubilees, or juster redistributions, under their ancient law. So the Teutonists boasted of tracing parliaments and juries and various popular things among the Germanic tribes of the north. So the Celtophiles and those testifying to the wrongs of Ireland have pleaded the more equal justice of the clan system, to which the Irish chiefs bore witness before Strongbow. The strength of the case varies in the different cases, but as there is some case for all of them, I suspect that there is some case for the general proposition that popular institutions of some sort were by no means uncommon in early and simple societies. Each of these separate schools were making the admission to prove a particular modern thesis, but taken together, they suggest a more ancient and general truth, that there was something more in prehistoric councils than ferocity and fear. Each of these separate theorists had his own axe to grind, but he was willing to use a stone axe, and he manages to suggest that the stone axe might have been as republican as the guillotine. But the truth is that the curtain rises upon the play already in progress. In one sense, it is a true paradox that there was history before history, but it is not the irrational paradox implied in prehistoric history, for it is a history we do not know. Very probably it was exceedingly like the history we do know, except in the one detail, that we do not know it. It is thus the very opposite of the pretentious prehistoric history, which professes to trace everything in a consistent course, from the amoeba to the anthropoid, and from the anthropoid to the agnostic. So far from being a question of our knowing all about queer creatures very different from ourselves, they were very probably people very like ourselves, except that we know nothing about them. In other words, our most ancient records only reach back to a time when humanity had long been human and even long been civilized. The most ancient records we have not only mention but take for granted things like kings and priests and princes and assemblies of the people. They describe communities that are roughly recognizable as communities in our own sense. Some of them are despotic, but we cannot tell that they have always been despotic. Some of them may be already decadent, and nearly all are mentioned as if they were old. We do not know what really happened in the world before those records, but the little we do know would leave us anything but astonished if we learnt that it was very much like what happens in the world now. There would be nothing inconsistent or confounding about the discovery that those unknown ages were full of republics collapsing under monarchies and rising again as republics, empires expanding and finding colonies and then losing colonies, kingdoms combining again into world states and breaking up again into small nationalities, classes selling themselves into slavery and marching out once more into liberty. All that procession of humanity, which may or may not be a progress, but most assuredly a romance. But the first chapters of the romance have been torn out of the book, and we shall never read them. It is so also with the more special fancy about evolution and social stability. According to the real records available, barbarism and civilization were not successive states in the history of the world. They were conditions that existed side by side, as they still exist side by side. There were civilizations then, as there are civilizations now. There are savages now, as there were savages then. It is suggested that all men pass through a nomadic stage, but it is certain that there are some who have never passed out of it, and it seems not unlikely that there were some who never passed into it. It is probable that from very primitive times, the static tiller of the soil and the wandering shepherd were two distinct types of men, and the chronological rearrangement of them is but a mark of that mania for progressive stages that has largely falsified history. It is suggested that there was a communist stage in which private property was everywhere unknown, a whole humanity living on the negation of property. But the evidences of this negation are themselves rather negative. Redistributions of property, jubilees, and agrarian laws occur at various intervals and in various forms. But that humanity inevitably passed through a communist stage seems as doubtful as the parallel proposition that humanity will inevitably return to it. It is chiefly interesting as evidence that the boldest plans for the future invoke the authority of the past, and that even a revolutionary seeks to satisfy himself that he is also a reactionary. There is an amusing parallel example in the case of what is called feminism. In spite of all the pseudo-scientific gossip about marriage by capture and the caveman beating the cavewoman with a club, it may be noted that as soon as feminism became a fashionable cry, it was insisted that human civilization in its first stage had been a matriarchy. Apparently, it was the cavewoman who carried the club. Anyhow, all these ideas are little better than guesses. They have a curious way of following the fortune of modern theories and fads. In any case, they are not history in the sense of record, and we may repeat that when it comes to record, the broad truth is that barbarism and civilization have always dwelt side by side in the world. The civilization sometimes spreading to absorb the barbarians, sometimes decaying into relative barbarism, and in almost all cases possessing in a more finished form certain ideas and institutions which the barbarians possess in a ruder form, such as government or social authority, the arts, and especially the decorative arts, mysteries and taboos of various kinds, especially surrounding the matter of sex, and some form of that fundamental thing which is the chief concern of this inquiry, the thing we call religion. Now, Egypt and Babylon, those two primeval monsters, might in this matter have been specially provided as models. They might almost be called working models, to show how these modern theories do not work. The two great truths we know about these two great cultures happen to contradict flatly the two current fallacies which have just been considered. The story of Egypt might have been invented to point the moral that man does not necessarily begin with despotism because he is barbarous, but very often finds his way to despotism because he is civilized. He finds it because he is experienced, or, what is often much the same thing, because he is exhausted. And the story of Babylon might have been invented to point the moral that a man need not be a nomad or a communist before he becomes a peasant or a citizen, and that such cultures are not always in successive stages, but often in contemporary states. Even touching these great civilizations with which our written history begins, there is a temptation, of course, to be too ingenious or too cocksure. We can read the bricks of Babylon in a very different sense than that in which we guess about the cup and ring stones. And we do definitely know what is meant by the animals in the Egyptian hieroglyphic, as we know nothing of the animal in the Neolithic cave. But even here, the admirable archaeologists who have deciphered line after line of miles of hieroglyphics may be tempted to read too much between the lines. Even the real authority on Babylon may forget how fragmentary is his hard-won knowledge, may forget that Babylon has only heaved half a brick at him, though half a brick is better than no cuneiform. But some truths, historic and not prehistoric, dogmatic and not evolutionary, facts and not fancies, do indeed emerge from Egypt and Babylon, and these true truths are among them. End of part 1 of chapter 3.